I'm going to try and follow both Bill's and Alex's admonishments that I stay close to the microphone, but if I wander away, I do as Rich is doing and say, hold your hand up to your ear so I know that I'm not speaking loudly. I also apologize. My allergies are acting up, so if I have to clear my throat occasionally, I apologize. Since I've committed to doing a series of services on the 7 UU principles, and since we have an election day coming up, now seems to be a good time to tackle the 5th principle, in which we UUs affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. You may recall that Western ideas about democracy grow out of the practices of ancient Greece, in which city-states were governed by the votes of property-owning citizens. This meant that people living in the city who were too poor to own property could not vote. Neither could women, neither could slaves. The right to vote was confined to a very few, and the original framers of the United States systems of governance embraced a similar ideal. In the early days of our country, only citizens who were white, who were male, and who were property owners were allowed to vote in most states. A lot has changed since then, but there are still many U.S. citizens who lack easy access to the ballot, and undemocratic efforts to restrict voting to only the privileged persist. Efforts here in Pennsylvania to curtail or invalidate voting by mail without providing another equitable solution to allow equal access to the vote for all citizens constitute just one example of many. This history and these current issues make the importance of our 5th principle clearer, since we readily see that the early implementations of democracy and current attempts to limit access to the ballot are in direct conflict with our 1st and 2nd principles, which call us as Unitarian Universalists to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and which call us to promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. If each person is worthy, and no person is more worthy than any other, then each person should have a voice in the decisions that affect them. A just and equitable society would ensure that all persons have equal opportunity to express their voice. The UU minister, Theodore Parker, sought to express kind of the difficulty embedded in this challenge in the following statement. Democracy means not I'm as good as you are, but you are as good as I am. I'll read that again. I had to think about that one for a little bit. Democracy means not I'm as good as you are, but you are as good as I am. In this declaration, Reverend Parker calls us to live our principles and trust that others, even those with whom we most disagree, are of equal worth and have an equal right to be heard and heeded. That's a challenge. It can be hard, especially hard to trust those who seem to be so clearly wrong-headed. Abraham Lincoln understood this as well. In his first inaugural address, he encourages us to trust and be patient, and now I quote, "Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better hope in all the world? In our present differences, is either party without faith of their being in the right? If the Almighty Ruler of Nations, with his eternal truth and justice, be on your side, citizens of the North, or on yours, citizens of the South, that truth and that justice will surely prevail by the judgment of this great tribunal of the American people." End quote. Lincoln begins by asking us to have a patient confidence in democracy, to trust that ultimately the people will decide rightly. He notes that there is no better hope in the world. Trusting in the will of the people to ultimately get it right is our best hope. And I'll note here, the term ultimate is critical here. There's plenty of evidence that we, the people, get it wrong in the short term, more often than not. But Lincoln asks us to trust that ultimately, in the long term, we will get it right. He goes on to note that in any difference or disagreement, each side has faith in the truth of their own position. And further, each side believes that God or divine wisdom or reason or whatever you hold sacred is on their side. He concludes by noting that if, in fact, the divine is on our side, then surely in the end we'll prevail. President Lincoln, of course, was speaking about the opposing positions of northern and southern states with respect to slavery, but he could just as easily have been speaking about any of the currently contentious issues that divide our nation. The challenge of embracing the democratic process is trusting in the wisdom of the people, particularly when we believe they are wrong and we are right. But as Lincoln points out, they are just as convinced of their own truth. So before we object too strongly, it's incumbent on us to do the work necessary to ensure that our will is in fact aligned with that of the divine. This is the real genius of the fifth principle. It affirms and promotes the right of conscience as well as the use of the democratic process. The full statement reads, "We affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large." This implies that it is the voice of our conscience and the conscience of others in our community that is expressed through the democratic process when it's functioning well. A. Powell Davies, a great Unitarian minister of the mid-20th century, called conscience the sight of the soul. I tend to think of conscience as the voice of the soul or the divine that dwells within each of us. That is the voice of the inner light of God within, Buddha nature, Allah, spirit of life, Jehovah. Each of us carries an inner spark of the divine, and the fifth principle recognizes that too often its voice is hidden or suppressed by the cacophony of other voices echoing within us. Fear, greed, jealousy, anger, and so on. You're no doubt familiar with the list. Recognizing that we are not always tuned into the conscience, the fifth principle calls out the right of conscience, to me, it's really the responsibility of conscience in promoting the use of the democratic process. Ideally, democratic processes will capture the voice of the divine expressing through each participant. So if we want to affirm and promote the use of the democratic processes within our congregation and society at large, our first task is to still our own inner noise and listen. In stillness, we can hear the voice of the divine within. There are many paths to stillness. As you may have heard me share in the past, a regular practice of silent seated meditation is essential to my mental and spiritual health. And in that stillness, clarity arises and the direction of the spirit becomes evident. If you haven't tried meditation, I encourage you to do so. Reverend Alex regularly leads meditation in our parish house next door at 6 o'clock on Wednesdays and Thursdays. You might consider joining him or at least asking him about it. Others find that prayer, journaling, chanting, contemplative walking are more reliable paths for them to greater awareness of the voice of conscience. It isn't really that important what your choice is. These are all good choices. What's important is that we cultivate our connection to the divine, that we have a regular practice. Once we have stilled our minds, we can encourage and support others in doing the same. And I find for myself that so often what I experience in our society is the shrillness of voices that are not the voice of the divine within, right? How do we help others, ourselves include others and ourselves, hear that voice, right? Find that way to inner light. This is what we commit to doing in the third and fourth UU principles, encouraging spiritual growth and a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. One way we can do this, and it does seem counterintuitive, but one way we can do this is to expand our listening practice from listening within to listening more deeply to others. Too often in conversation, and even more often in disagreements, we focus only on being heard and give little or no attention to listening. Carol and I recently completed training to become facilitators for Friends Couple Enrichment, That's a Quaker-based program that helps couples deepen and strengthen their relationships. The central practices of the program are designed to enhance a couple's communication, primarily through developing better habits, better listening habits. Developing better listening skills has been transformative in our relationship. Two of the listening practices we have learned and that I want to share today are clear listening and reflective listening, which are helpful not only in relationships, but in other contexts. When practicing clear listening, we give the speaker our undivided, silent attention, as if listening to a piece of fine music, and we seek to hear and understand what is being said. This takes effort. The challenge is to listen without responding, either out loud or internally. We may find we can keep our mouths shut and not respond vocally, and that I find fairly easy, but stopping my brain from responding, from formulating suggestions or rebuttals, from reframing what's being said, from all those ways that we latch onto and respond inside to people's comments, that's a real effort to just listen and try to understand. It takes practice to do well. I'll be speaking for a few more minutes this morning, so you might give clear listening a try and see how it goes. Clear listening, that is seeking to hear and understand without responding, benefits both speaker and listener, particularly when the speaker is distraught, combative, or in reaction to something. Since the listener is only listening and not responding, the speaker has an opportunity to share what's on their minds without fear of interruption or argument, right? And when someone is listening to us, I don't know, I'll speak for myself. When someone's listening to me, I can tell when they're truly listening, seeking just to understand, and when their brains are going and they're working on how they're going to respond or what they disagree with or those kinds of things. So sitting and just listening is really, it's a really incredible discipline. It allows the speaker to slow down and to de-escalate emotionally. As they calm, it creates the possibility that they can begin to listen to themselves. And in the process, they may gain new insights of what they really feel or believe, opening the door for a new self-understanding, opening the door to hear that inner voice of wisdom. I sometimes describe such listening as listening into being. As a listener, I'm helping the speaker develop a more authentic connection to themselves and to the voice of the divine within. And the benefits of clear listening are not confined to the speaker. As a listener, I have found that once I still my internal responses, I have the space to actually hear what is being said and appreciate the perspective of the speaker. Clear listening creates space for both speaker and listener to hear the voice of conscience. Reflective listening, the other listening practice I want to share this morning, is a common practice, and you may have run across it before. We can think of reflective listening as an extension of clear listening. It's based first on clear listening. As with clear listening, my goal as a listener is to give the speaker my undivided attention, seeking to hear and understand what is being said. What's new is that in reflective listening, is at regular intervals, I reflect back to the speaker in my own words what I've heard or understood, and then I check with them to make sure that I understood correctly. It's important in these reflections that they occur without judgment or interpretation and remain as close to as possible to reflecting what I believe the speaker said. This adds a new challenge, since it's tempting always when doing this to insert my own reactions or thoughts or interpretations. But Carol and I have found it's worth the effort to hew to the practice of only reflecting what the speaker has said and not responding. As a speaker, when I hear my own words reflected back, I sometimes realize, and it's more often than you might believe, I realize that I didn't say what I meant, or maybe I meant what I said, but now when I hear it, I don't really mean it. Sometimes I realize I probably never actually meant that, but it just was kind of echoing around in my head. But now that it's out there and I can look at it, I say, yeah, no, yeah, well, let's start over, right? That's not what I really, that's not where I really am. Let me share where I really am. As with clear listening, not having to worry about defending myself from a response allows me to take time to figure out what I really want to say, to better understand what it is I really believe. As a listener, reflecting back my understanding of what I heard will reveal moments when I'm misunderstanding what is being said and provide the speaker an opportunity to clarify. In our experience, this practice is a surprisingly effective way to develop common understandings, including understandings about potentially contentious issues. Importantly, practicing listening to ourselves, to our partners and our friends, to others we encounter, resonates with our commitments to the first UU principle. By listening, really listening to ourselves and to others, we affirm their worth and our worth, our inherent worth and dignity. We cultivate the voice of the divine within each of us and build the foundation necessary for effective democracy. Listening alone will not be enough to cure all of the ills that bedevil our democracy. So please vote on Tuesday. But it's a great place to start. After all, there's no reason for others to listen to us if we are too busy speaking or reacting to listen to them. Blessed be, and amen.